Welcome to Current Sports. I'm your host, Al Martin. And you all know that today, on Wednesday, is one of my favorite days of the week because of one thing, Barbershop Wednesdays. Yes, it's when I invite my production assistants, Alex Sharg and Matt Lutke, in the studio with me to debate a hot topic in the world of sports, just like if you were in the barbershop, because we all know how barbershops are. I mean, you walk in, there's always a sports debate going on. And on today's show, in honor of the NBA draft that will be taking place tomorrow, we'll be discussing whether or not the NBA should go back to allowing high school players to make the jump straight from high school to the pros. Now, just like players, just like Kobe Bryant, Kevin Garnett, of course LeBron James, they've all done it. Now, we want you to make a comment on our Facebook page at facebook.com/currentsports. Tweet me at almartin@wkar.org. Shoot me an email at almartin@wkar.org, or even call us at 140 at 517-355-9527, and we'll read your comments live on the air during Barbershop Wednesdays today. Again, that starts at 140. Leave us a comment on Facebook. Tweet me. We want to hear what's on your mind. So in the meantime, we have a special guest joining us on today's show that has written a book about one of the most interesting athletes, to say the least, in Detroit sports history. Now, does the name Mark Fidrich ring a bell? Well, maybe not to the younger generation, but to those a little older, you may have just cracked a big smile after hearing that name. Because, yes, he was like a breath of fresh air, ladies and gents. He was a pitcher for the Detroit Tigers who began his career in the mid to late 70s with the team. Now, what made Mark so intriguing was his personality on the mound. I mean, he would do things like crouch down on the pitcher's mound and fix cleat marks, something that became known as manicuring the mound. He would talk to the ball. He would strut around the mound after every out. He would throw balls back that, quote, had hits in them, insisting that they'll be removed from the game. His nickname was the Bird because of his mop-like hair and features that resembled that of Big Bird from Sesame Street. Yes, this guy was quite a character, but also one heck of a pitcher that seemed to transcend the game and pop culture at the same time. Well, today we invite a man on today's Current Sports who knows a lot about Mark's impact firsthand, because he has a new book out called, quote, The Bird, The Life and Legacy of Mark Fidrich. Doug Wilson, welcome to Current Sports.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Thanks a lot. We appreciate you coming on the show, man. So, Doug, first of all, what inspired you to write this documentary, if you will, of on Mark Fidrich's life?
Well, I grew up in the 60s and 70s following baseball, and looking back, I decided I wanted to write a book about one of the good things of baseball, something that made everybody feel good about themselves and about the game. And looking back, really, there's never been a phenomenon like what the Bird created in Detroit that year. Just the whole explosion of popularity. You know, by the end of the year, he was the most popular athlete in the country. Mm-hmm. And I was amazed that nobody had really written a book about it over the years. And I thought it'd be a good time to look back.
So during your research, Doug, I mean, who are some of the people that you talked to in your research for this book upon writing it?
Well, I started off with his sisters. He had three sisters. They were a close family, and they got me in touch with a lot of kids who grew up with him in the neighborhood just to find out kind of the background of his personality and some of his antics to see where that came from. And then I talked to his high school baseball coach and his American Legion coaches and quite a few guys who played with him in the minors and quite a few people that played with him in the majors, his catcher Bruce Kim, John Walkenfuss, a lot of the other pitchers, Frank McCormick, John Hiller. I was lucky enough to get a hold of Ralph Houck, his manager. He was 93 years old, living in Florida, and he had a lot of interesting comments to say.
Wow. Now for you, Doug, you did a lot of research with his family growing up. What did you find about Mark's family background to be like growing up?
Well, then the one thing that his sister said was what you saw out on the mound, that's exactly the way it was in the house every single day. I mean, there was never a dull moment. He was just a guy with an endless amount of energy, always had a huge smile on his face. always into something. And, a sister said our whole childhood was filled with trips to the hospital and bandages on Mark.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're talking with Doug Wilson. Doug has a new book out called The Bird, The Life and Legacy of Mark Fittridge. Mark was an unbelievable legend, if you will, in Detroit Tigers history. Many know about, Fittridge's antics on the mound, like manicuring the mound, talking to the ball, throwing balls back with hits on them. I mean, where did those antics come from?
Well, the thing with the mound was really his father had taught him that. And in Little League, he just told him to make sure he was comfortable on the mound, don't step in the other guy's hole. And most pitchers will do that with their foot, but Mark sort of took that to an extreme. And some of the other things, he was, nowadays they would put him on medicine and call him an ADD. He had difficulty being focused, and his father realized that, and some of the things he gave him to incorporate into a routine, talking to himself, telling him the situation, just helped him kind of lock in and concentrate.
Mm-hmm.
But when he got on the mound, he was totally oblivious to anybody else around watching him, and his enthusiasm and energy just took over, and he just did those things.
So, Doug, what many people deemed as quote-unquote weird, I mean, this is just how Mark was.
Yeah, yeah.
It was just a part of his DNA.
Yeah, and if somebody would make a play behind him, even just a routine play, he'd be shaking his fist, pointing at him, grabbing him. And, all the other guys on the team got into it. You would have thought that some of them would have been jealous with him getting the attention, but they all loved playing with him. He made the game fun, and they loved the crowds that started coming to watch him.
Mm-hmm. Right. Now, Doug, talk about Mark's career and when he first got his chance with the Tigers.
Well, he came up, he was kind of an unknown to most media and fans. You could do that back in those days. They didn't have all the internet and things to track people, but he had had a very good year in the minors the year before, but he was a non-roster pitcher in spring training in 76. He made the team. Hawk pitched him in relief a couple times to let him get his feet wet, and he didn't make his first start till about the middle of May.
Mm-hmm.
But when he took the mound against the Indians in Detroit, he threw a two-hitter, won the game 2-1. And the guys in the other dugouts, the guys in the press box started noticing that not only was he winning games, he was doing some pretty strange things out on the field. And over the next month, it just gradually built up. More people were coming out.
Now, Doug, I read that Mark was just such a popular player that opposing teams would sometimes even ask the Tigers if he would pitch on a certain day while on the road just to attract people. I mean, certainly a cultural figure. I mean, even the first athlete to grace the cover of Rolling Stone magazine. I mean, talk about his impact culturally.
Well, like you said, after halfway through the season, almost every game he pitched, there were 40,000 to 50,000 fans, home and on the road. He single-handedly outdrew four other teams for the season just in his 29 starts.
Mm-hmm.
And, the general managers knew if the Bird made an appearance in their park, that was a sellout that night. And so they wanted them to juggle the lineup. But, everywhere he went, the fans were there. People were in the airport, grocery stores, hanging around his apartment. But he really loved it. He was just a guy who enjoyed connecting with people. And the fans could see that, and that's what kept making them come back.
Right, definitely. And also, Doug, I think we have a call from Kirk from Grand Ledge. He has a question for you, Doug. Kirk, how you doing, man?
I'm doing just fine, thank you. This is the first time I've had a chance to call into your show. I was a regular caller with Earl.
Oh, thanks a lot for calling, man.
Yeah, I just wanted to verify or maybe validate what he's saying about Fittridge drawing fans. I grew up 26 miles south of Tiger Stadium, and in 1976, the Tigers stunk. They were a very bad baseball team.
Mm-hmm.
And the only time we went to Tiger Stadium that year was when Fittridge was pitching. And it was amazing the amount of energy that was generated when he was on the mound and how the players around him, even though they were pretty mediocre players, responded. We went and saw him at Tiger Stadium, I think, four or five times. And it was an event every single time. And I dare say he may have outdrawn the rest of the Tiger team when they were at Tiger Stadium, if it wasn't Fitter's pitching that place, you could have shot a cannon off in it. But on the night he was there, it was standing room only.
Kirk, have you seen anything like that in baseball today?
No. There are some young players right now that draw an awful lot of excitement and attention, like the Bryce Harpers and maybe a Mike Trout or whatever, but nothing like Fidrich. I mean, maybe it's because the difference was that Fidrich was a pitcher and not an everyday player, so you only got a chance to see him every 4 days.
Mm-hmm.
But it was an amazing phenomenon. It was I was a senior in high school, or it was after I graduated from high school before I went to college in 1976,
mm-hmm.
and it was just awesome to be there, be part of that.
Oh, man, I'm sure. And I wish I had a time machine now. Well, Kirk, hey, thanks a lot for your call. Really appreciate it, man.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Wow, Doug. I mean, that's just a firsthand, you know, recollection of, the impact that Fitrich had back in the day. Now, Doug, what was Mark's lifestyle like away from baseball?
Well, he was pretty famously casual. He was from a real small town in Massachusetts, and after his first big game, People magazine sent a reporter over to his apartment, and they reported to the country he had sheets hanging on the windows instead of curtains. He was sleeping on a mattress on the floor, didn't have a bed, didn't have a telephone, didn't have a TV. He told the reporter, he said, "Yeah, I'm usually clean, but every now and then I let my dishes stack up, but they don't get too high because I only have four." And so he was happy just living a simple lifestyle, and he was making the major league minimum, $16,000 a year, which mm-hmm. is pretty unbelievable nowadays looking at the salaries. But the reporters asked him, "You're drawing $500,000 every game, you should be getting more money." And he told him, "What do I want more money for? 2 years ago I was making $2 an hour at a gas station. This is more than I ever had."
Wow.
And he was happy with that. He didn't get an agent. He negotiated his contract by himself, and he was loyal to the Tigers, and fans ate that up. That was what they wanted to hear at the time.
We're talking with Doug Wilson. He has a new book highlighting Mark Fidrich's life. Fidrich was, of course, a Detroit Tigers pitching legend back in the day. They nicknamed him the Bird. Doug's book is called The Bird, The Life and Legacy of Mark Fidrich. So, Doug, now Mark was injured. He injured his knee in 1977, an injury that he worked through, but it was when he injured his rotator cuff that really hindered his career. When he got his shoulder repaired, did he ever talk about returning back to the game?
One of the frustrating things was when he hurt his arm, that was before the days of MRIs and things like that, so they didn't really know he had a torn rotator cuff. And so he tried for about 5 years to come back. He tried everything, all kinds of hokey diets, medicine, hypnotism. But after he had finally retired, about 2 years later, he went down to Dr. James Andrews, and by then they could do arthroscopic surgery, and they found the rotator cuff and fixed it. But by then he had been out of baseball 3 years. He was 33, and, his life had moved on, and so it was too late.
So what was life for him like after baseball?
I was actually pretty good. Again, when he was a young kid on top of the world, he had always told reporters he liked trucks, he liked fiddling with engines, and he wanted to be a farmer. Of course, they thought, that's just more evidence of him being a nut. But when he got out, that's exactly what he did. He had saved some of his money. He bought some nice land in the small town that he lived in, raised pigs. He got a big dump truck, and he was basically a blue-collar worker. Get up at 5 in the morning, go haul asphalt and gravel all day, come home, work the pigs. And he was happy.
Wow.
He loved it. He married a girl from his high school, had a daughter, and he spent a lot of time doing charity work. He was always happy to put on his Tigers hat, get out and meet people, and he never really expressed any bitterness for his injury or what happened.
Now, for you, Doug, when looking at Mark's life and putting together this book of yours, what do you think for you is the most fascinating part of his life when you were going through the process of putting this book together?
Well, again, that whole attitude. of not being bitter. You know, if you look at it one way, he missed the free agent era, and by 2 years, he would have made millions. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he missed the diagnosis and being able to fix his arm by 2 to 3 years. If they had fixed it, he could have had a 15, 20-year career. But, you know, he never looked back and felt bad about that. He always just told everybody he was happy for what he had and happy for what it got him. But, you know, the other surprising thing is like what the caller mentioned, is you talk to people now, it's hard to explain the phenomena of being in a ballpark when he was there because there's nothing to compare it to.
Right.
You know, people talk about Lynn Sanity a few years ago, and you know, I just say he made Lynn Sanity look like a church bingo party. I mean, you had 50,000 people just on their feet screaming nonstop the whole game.
Right.
Every single game when he finished, they called him back out. You know, in a midseason game for a fifth place team, they called him out for curtain calls every single game.
Wow.
And, you know, there's nothing to compare it to because there hasn't been anything like that since.
Even Lynn, I remember when Lynn Sanity was taking off, man. I mean, everybody was talking about Jeremy Lin. You say that a church bingo party is what you compare it to.
Yeah, you know, everybody say it was just a massive 2-hour party every single time he took the mound.
Wow. But like I said, I wish I had a time machine to go back. Ladies and gents, we're talking with Doug Wilson. He has a new book highlighting Mark Fidrich's life. Mark Fidrich is a legendary Tigers pitcher back in the late 70s. Doug has a new book out highlighting Mark's life entitled The Bird, The Life and Legacy of Mark Fidrich. So, Doug, for you, let's look at Mark's death now. Now, he passed away in 2009. Now, there are reports that say he was working on a truck one day when his clothes got tangled in a certain part of the truck, ended up suffocating him. Really a freak accident. Is that accurate? Is that what happened?
Yeah. And, you know, I didn't go into real great detail in the book, mainly because I just felt like I wanted to concentrate on how this guy lived and not how he died. But,
mm-hmm.
but yeah, it was just he got up one day, just like any other day of his life. He was working on his truck by himself at home that day, and part of his clothes got tangled in the rotary part of the engine, and, you know, it was over in a minute or less. And, yeah, it was really a shock to everybody who knew him. Of course, his family, you know, that's something you never get over.
Wow, unbelievable, man. So what do you think Mark's legacy is, Doug?
Again, a couple things. One is a guy who came along when baseball really needed it because the game was flagging. The game was dropping in popularity. He came along and made the game fun. He just enjoyed it. And then also a guy who gave back to his community, who was always willing to do charity, who always had a positive attitude after he got out of the game. And that's something that, you know, a lot of modern players could look at that as a role of how to be remembered.
Very, very true. So, Doug, how can people get your book?
Well, hopefully it's in most good bookstores. Of course, it's online at barnesandnoble.com or amazon.com. And also, I'm going to be appearing this Saturday at 1 o'clock in Lansing at the Schuller Bookstore on Town Center Boulevard. So I'll be there talking and hopefully hearing some more good bird stories.
Again, you just took the words out of my mouth. Let people know that Doug will be at Town Center Boulevard at Schuller's Bookstore in Lansing this Saturday, 1 o'clock, to promote the book, do signings. Definitely look forward to that. Doug Wilson, author of The Bird, The Life and Legacy of Mark Fidrich. Go pick it up. Doug, thanks so much for joining us here on Current Sports.
Okay, well, thanks for having me.
No problem. All right, when we return to Current Sports, we'll dive into our Current Sports section of the show. I want to let you know we'll be taking your calls at 140. Don't hesitate to pick up the phone and dial 517-355-9527. Again, 517-355-9527. Let us hear your thoughts on any of today's topics. Want to hear what's on your mind? Stay tuned. More Current Sports is next.
7 days a week, Current State brings you the issues, personalities, and events making the heart of Mid-Michigan beat.
To be able to start a farmer's market takes time and energy, people power, and planning.
We change the notes, or we change the phrasing, or we change something for what might happen, and you can't really predict, and that's the beauty of jazz.
We are reinventing city government as we go along. It's like redesigning the airplane while in flight.
Current State, weekdays at 9 a.m. and 6 p.m. on 90.5 WKAR.
You count on All Things Considered for many reasons. The biggest stories of the day, from around the world to your own backyard. The thoughtful commentaries, the insightful features, or all of the above. All Things Considered has been your trusted source for news every afternoon. I'm Brad Walker, your host for All Things Considered, and glad to be a part of this show. I'll see you at 4 this afternoon.
Welcome back to Current Sports. I'm your host, Al Martin. It's now time for Current Sports. Now, we're going to get to the whole Aaron Hernandez. He was just arrested. That's why I'm playing Bad Boys right now. Aaron Hernandez has just been arrested. We're going to get to that story in just a sec. Remind you all, we'll be taking your calls about any of today's topics at 140-517-355-9527. We just finished talking with author Doug Wilson. He has a new book coming out entitled The Bird, The Life and Legacy of Mark Fidrich. Again, Doug will be at Schuler's Bookstore at Town Center Boulevard this Saturday, 1 o'clock, to promote the book and do signings. Very interesting conversation with him about Mark Fidrich, who was a legendary pitcher with the Detroit Tigers in the late 70s. I mean, the whole phenomena of Mark is just unbelievable. But, you know, you can pick up the book right now online, any bookstore. Really interesting stuff. And also want to remind you guys that, you know, in light of it being Barbershop Wednesday today, again, I'm inviting, you know, of course, on Barbershop Wednesdays, I invite Alex Sharg and Matt Lucky to join me, and we debate about a sports topic. And today's topic is, should high school athletes make the jump from high school straight to the pros and go straight to the NBA when it comes to National Basketball Association? Players like Kobe Bryant, Kevin Garnett have done it. I mean, LeBron James, I could go on and on. Do you agree with that? So go on to our Facebook page at facebook.com/currentsports. Tweet me at Al Martin, WKAR, or shoot me an email, almartin@wkar.org, or simply call us when 140 hits. We want to hear your thoughts on that. And if you leave us a comment on Facebook, we will read it live on the air. All right, let's dig into today's topics. The Detroit Tigers fall in game one of a 3-game set to the LA Angels. And, folks, this one wasn't even close. 14-3, your final last night. Tigers lose. Man, the Angels are 4-0 against the Tigers this season. Have outscored them, get this, 36 to 12. I had to look at that again to make sure I'm reading that right. That's mind-boggling. 36-12. The Angels have certainly had the Tigers' number this season so far. And last night's game was the highest scoring game for the Angels this season. It was the second longest 9-inning game in baseball this season due to the constant scoring that the LA Angels were producing on the Tigers. Unbelievable. The Tigers just can't seem to beat the Los Angeles Angels. So Rick Porcello was on the mound starting for the Tigers. He really struggled. Now, a week ago, the Tigers starting pitching looked like, you know, it looked very, very good. Very, very good. I remember myself, I was, you know, praising it. Now, they led the league with 47 quality starts, starts of at least 6 innings and no more than 3 earned runs. And they had gotten a quality start in all but 2 of their last 23 games, an unbelievable streak. Hottest in baseball. Now, in the seven games since that, the Tigers are 1-for-7 in quality starts, with the only one by unbeaten, of course, Max Scherzer. Now, in the other 6 games, the starters have averaged about 5 innings with an ERA of 9.42. In his 4 1/3 innings Tuesday night, Porcello gave up 7 earned runs. I don't know what's going on right now, but the Tigers starting pitching has really taken the slump. especially, in, like I said, in these past seven games, really questionable. And it didn't look great last night with Rick Porcello on the mound. Now, Rick Porcello, who allowed 9 first-inning runs the last time he faced the L.A. Angels. Now, he retired them in order in his first Tuesday, in the first inning yesterday at Comerica. And then he retired the first two hitters in the second and then would strike out Josh Hamilton. But after that yesterday, 10 of the next 19 Angels got a hit off Porcello. 10 of the next 19. So, man, this is one of those things where the Angels, they just simply have the Tigers' number. That's something Torrey Hunter talked about after the game.
Well, you know, you always have that team that, you know, or, you know, that team that you beat up, you know, and then when they go somewhere else, they beat up on everybody else. And the Angels right now, they just got our number, you know. They beat us at their place, and they beat us down today. So that's the way it goes. The Astros, you know, actually beat those guys. So, and we beat the Astros. So it's a crazy game, man. And I always say it, it's round ball, round bat. Never know what's going to happen.
You never know what's going to happen. And in the case of the Tigers and Angels, the Angels have, you know, you kind of know what's going to happen. I mean, 4-0 against the Tigers this season. So, tonight, you know, the play resumes. It's a 3-game set. This will be game 2 tonight. Now, also want to note that the Tigers have agreed to terms with 2 of this year's draft picks, right-hander pitchers Jeff Thompson and Chad Green. The Tigers also came to terms with right-handed pitcher Joe Jimenez, an undrafted free agent. And, all right, tonight, Tommy Hansen, a right-handed pitcher, starts for the Angels, and left-handed pitcher Jose Alvarez, who is 1-0, he will start for the Tigers. So, again, Tigers just get whooped on 14-3. And the Angels, again, they have outscored the Tigers 36-12. Let's see if the Tigers can shake it off and move on. All right, Trevor Manuel, he is leaving Lansing Sexton. Yes, the 6'9" forward. Trevor Manuel will be leaving Lansing Sexton High School to play basketball elsewhere. He's leaving and likely headed to a prep school. That's what his father, James, said Tuesday afternoon. And his father was quoted in the Lansing State Journal as saying, quote, all the top prep schools have pretty much offered him scholarships, so we're basically just visiting and talking to schools, trying to figure out what will be the best fit for him. That's James Manuel, his dad, talking there. Now, they hope to decide on a school by the second or third week in July. Now, the decision to leave Sexton was really made because of Carlton Valentine, the head coach over there at Lansing Sexton, who was, you know, brought, you know, a couple, you know, state championships galore over there. He has departed as the Big Reds coach. And this is kind of a way for Manuel to face better competition and to, you know, go to another school and, you know, just to really have a fresh start at things. Now, Manuel is a very good player. He's rated number 42 in the nation by Rivals and number 45 by ESPN. So he is a top 50 high school basketball player. Like I said, he's a pretty big kid, 6'9", is very athletic, jumps with ease. Now, he owes an offer from Michigan State and has generated interest from many, many major programs. Now, while at Sexton, Manuel averaged 12.1 points, 9 rebounds, and he was also named honorable mention All-State in Class B and helped the Big Reds to a 16-7 record last season as a sophomore, and was also a member of Sexton's state championship team as a freshman. So this is a kid who has a lot of talent. Like I said, a big reason is I think if Carlton Valentine, you know, said that he was staying for next year, I think you would have seen Trevor stay as well. Carlton Valentine is an incredible coach, has built a very good program over there at Lansing Sexton. But again, Carlton wants to spend more time, you know, with his sons. You know, Denzel, of course, who plays for Michigan State, he wants to attend more of his games. And I'm sure some of those games on the road, he'd like to travel a little bit more. We'll also have Carlton Valentine. He's scheduled to come on the show tomorrow to talk about his retirement. I'm sure he'll weigh in on Trevor Manuel leaving Sexton. All right, and Tempe Brown, she is also leaving the Lansing area. Tempe Brown, for those of you who don't know, she is the assistant coach for the MSU women's basketball team. And she'll be leaving the program to join Stanford University as an assistant there for their women's basketball program. Now, Brown spent the past 4 seasons at Michigan State, rising to the position of associate head coach, and she helped guide the Spartans to, you know, the NCAA tournament appearances in each of her seasons in East Lansing. Over the span, the Spartans went 95-37 overall, including a 46-20 mark in conference play, as the team never finished lower than third in the Big Ten standing. So Tempe was a great mentor, a great coach. Of course, she's moving on to go to Stanford University as an assistant there. Now, including her stint at Michigan State, she spent the past 14 years in the collegiate college coaching ranks. Now, prior to arriving in East Lansing, she served as assistant coach over at Memphis. That was in 2008 and 2009, Northwestern in 04 through 08, and Lehigh from 2002 to 2004, and I can go on and on, Eastern Michigan, Saginaw Valley State. So her experience is through the roof, and also under Brown's tutelage, she's a very good mentor when it comes to the point guard position, the guard position in general. Five Spartan guards garnered all Big Ten recognition over the past four seasons. You know, players like Jasmine Thomas, Kiana Johnson, Clarissa Bell, they were each honored in 2013, while Portia Poole, Brittany Thomas, they were also singled out by the conference for their stellar play. Brown is definitely a mentor to them, and she's an outstanding coach, and we wish her all the best here at Current Sports as she moves on to Stanford University. All right, let's move on now. A-Rod, Alex Rodriguez. Yes, he has angered Yankees GM. it's a pretty funny story to tell you. Now, less than a month after creating his own Twitter account, A-Rod, Alex Rodriguez, has gotten himself into some hot water with the Yankees. The injured third baseman tweeted yesterday that he has been cleared to play in games by his doctor, while the Yankees have been saying that he isn't ready to do anything except for simulated games so far in his rehab process. Now, that prompted a very, very angry response from Yankees GM Brian Cashman. And Brian responded with, quote, "You know what? When the Yankees want to announce something, we will." That's what he told ESPN New York. And he goes on to say, quote, "Alex should just shut the blah, blah, blah up. That's it. I'm going to call Alex now." So Brian, not a happy camper after that A-Rod tweet saying that, you know, he's cleared to play. And, you know, you never want to upset your GM. And Alex, you know, Alex is really, when it comes to the Yankees, he's not having a good time over there, I tell you that. Cashman goes on to say he has not been cleared by doctors to play in rehab games yet. He's getting closer, there's no doubt about it, but we don't have a date for him to start playing games yet. It could be July 1st, it could be July 5th, June 25th. I mean, you can go on and on. So Cashman did email Rodriguez. He didn't get an immediate response regarding the whole Twitter situation. And, when you look at this history with A-Rod and his relationship with the Yankees as of recently, it has not been good. Of course, his terrible play last season in the ALCS, of course. And also, you know, team officials, they were aware that Rodriguez actually asked for a woman's phone number in the stands during game one of the ALCS loss to the Tigers. So A-Rod is just not, you know, not pleasing the Yankees organization with some of his actions as of late. But, you know, interesting stuff. So, and also, of course, with the whole Biogenesis PED scandal, A-Rod's name is listed on that scandal. He is among those names who have appeared on several documents in that whole Anthony Bosch investigation. And he could, you know, possibly be on that list to possibly sit out 100 games. So, interesting stuff. A-Rod is just staying in trouble, guys, with the Yankees. They're not happy with him. All right, Aaron Hernandez. Yes, he was arrested this morning, more than a week after an acquaintance of the New England Patriots tight end was found dead in an industrial park near his house. Now, less than 2 hours following his arrest, Hernandez was also released by the New England Patriots, who initially announced the transaction on their own Twitter account, before formalizing it in an official statement. So, Aaron, this whole situation is so crazy. It's just developing day by day by day. As you all know, if I was to take you, you know, through this timeline. Now, on June 17th, the body of Odin Lloyd, that's the acquaintance that Aaron Hernandez is being linked with this whole situation. But the body of Odin Lloyd, that's his name, was found 1 mile from Hernandez's home. Then on June 18th, police searched the home of Hernandez and removed boxes. On June 20th, there was a lawsuit filed alleging that Hernandez shot a man in the face. That lawsuit was filed, and police also that same day on June 20th, they learned that his security system was destroyed, his cell phone was destroyed, and a cleaning service came over and cleaned his entire home, his entire mansion. Now, if that doesn't sound like a guilty man, I don't know what is. As I go on, June 21st, police prepare an arrest warrant for obstruction of justice. Then on June 22nd, police remove 15 bags of evidence from his house. And on Monday, police searched a pine near his home. And now today, Aaron Hernandez has been arrested. This does not look good. Again, he has been released by the New England Patriots. He is in custody, and he walked out today. He had on red shorts, a white T-shirt. His hands were kind of tucked in the armholes of the shirt, I guess to hide the cuffs or whatever, but it just looked stupid to me, if you ask me. But he was taken from the home, put in the back of a cruiser, and drove off. So this does not look good for Aaron Hernandez, and this story just seems to, as we know more, now the evidence and what he's being charged with, all of that information is being held confidential from the public right now. I'm sure it will come out in the coming days. So just want to update you guys on that. All right, UCLA, they completed a 10-game run through college baseball's postseason yesterday, rolling past Mississippi State 8-0 to win the College World Series. And this is the school's first national championship, first baseball national championship in the program's 94-year history. Congrats to UCLA, well-deserving of it. Here's the coach talking about this historic win.
So proud of our program, players, coaches. This is for the UCLA baseball family. And it's an honor and a privilege to be the coach at UCLA. And I'm just so proud. These guys did it on the field. I don't think any of the experts thought we'd be there, be here at this stage. And we did it. We did it the right way. We played baseball, and good baseball. And we pitched. We defended. We had quality offense, opportunistic offense for sure. And at the end of the day, I think we outlasted everybody. So congratulations to our players and their families and everybody associated with UCLA baseball. Thank you.
Unbelievable stuff. UCLA wins the College Baseball World Series. This is their first in the program's 94-year history. Unbelievable, guys. Congrats to UCLA. All right, Casey Martin. I don't know if you guys have been following this, but Casey Martin, he actually sued the PGA Tour in 2001 for the right to ride a golf cart in tour events, and he won, citing the Americans with Disabilities Act, and was told by the U.S. Golf Association on Monday that his cart was not allowed at a U.S. junior amateur qualifier out in Oceanside, California. Now, Martin, born with a debilitating birth defect in his right leg, makes walking very difficult. He's actually the golf coach at the University of Oregon. Now, according to USA Today, Martin cleared his plan to ride his cart at the tournament with Chairman Pat Pollock, also the director of rules, but after five or six holes, Martin was told he was not permitted to ride as a spectator. Of course, Martin is there to recruit, you know, some possible golfers to the University of Oregon, but, you know, the USGA is not allowing it now, and they make a statement saying, quote, "The unfortunate situation at the U.S. Junior Qualifier stems from a misunderstanding over the USGA cart policy at our championship events. We regret that this misunderstanding may have caused Casey an inconvenience, but it certainly was not intentional." So interesting stuff right there. Guys, this is kind of a prelude to next week, in which we will tackle the topic of disabilities in sports. We will also talk about this Casey Martin story. And also want to note, guys, before we move on to Barbershop Wednesday, that the NCAA has handed the Oregon Ducks a 3-year probation and also taken away a scholarship over that same span through June 2016 for recruiting violations under previous coach Chip Kelly. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we have to move on to our last segment of Current Sports. We're going to take your calls about any of the topics discussed today, 517-355-9527. Hit me up on Facebook.com/Current Sports. Tweet me a question at Al Martin WKR. I want to hear what's on your mind. Stick around. More Current Sports is next.
On the next Fresh Air, why the Lyme disease infection rate is growing, and so is the battle over how to treat it. We talk with Michael Spector about his article, The Lyme Wars, in the current edition of The New Yorker. He'll also tell us what's recommended if you find a tick on your body or your child's that might be carrying Lyme. Join us.
That's Fresh Air coming up at 3 o'clock. Welcome back to Current Sports. I'm your host, Al Martin. We'll be taking your calls right now to discuss anything that's on your noggin. Again, 517-355-9527. That's 517-355-9527. Give us a buzz. And ladies and gents, it's Wednesday. This is my favorite time of the week because it is Barbershop Wednesday. I'm joined by my production assistants, Alex Sharg and Matt Lucky, and today we have a special guest joining us here for the very first time on Barbershop Wednesday. He's also a sports nut as well. We welcome the producer of Current State, which airs every weekday morning from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. on WKAR 90.5, Joe Lindstroth. Welcome to Current Sports.
Wow, that was an incredible introduction, Al. Thank you.
We do it big here, man. I got to do it big on any new guest that
wow.
we have.
Thank you. Wow, you're rolling out the red carpet. And I'm here just for the plug of Current State.
Just for the plug.
Yeah,
that's all.
Exactly.
That's the only reason he's here right now. Well, we welcome Joe to debate a very interesting topic in light of the NBA draft, which will be taking place tomorrow at the Barclays Arena in Brooklyn, New York, tomorrow at 7 p.m., We're going to discuss a topic that's been, you know, on and on throughout the years. You've constantly heard about this topic. Should high school basketball players be allowed to make the jump from high school straight to the NBA? So, who wants to start this thing, baby?
Well,
go ahead, Joe. Go ahead.
You know, it's funny.
You're the guest, so yeah, go ahead.
Okay, all right. I'll give it a start. It's funny. I'm back on the new Current Sports here talking about this topic because before you arrived, Al, the one other appearance I made on our AM station was talking about athletes and whether they should be paid in the NCAA. So it's a very similar conversation, and I expressed some strong opinions about this. I think I'll throw it out there and start with just a simple fact that I believe that these kids should be allowed to maximize their earning potential whenever they decide and see fit to do so. These are 18-year-old kids, and, they only have a short lifespan in which they can make their money with their athletic talents. Let's give them the opportunity to do so. And I'll throw it out there, too, and anyone is going to say, it's better for the athlete to maybe have a year in school at NCAA. The NCAA and the NBA don't care less. Couldn't care less about the individual athletes and what's best for them. It's all about the bills.
It's all about money, baby.
Yeah,
that's what it's all about. And I agree with Joe. I mean, another thing is a lot of these athletes, they come out of high school areas, especially when you talk about African American athletes. Let's face it, the NBA is comprised of mostly African American athletes. They come from backgrounds that aren't that great, and if they have opportunity, they have the skill set to go and make that leap, and if scouts feel as though they do have that skill set, why not give them an opportunity if the money's there to better the lives of their family and better their lives of their career?
Yeah, it's tough to argue with, $3 million staring you in the face. It's tough to say no, and you look at the one-and-done rule, which is in place now, And you look at a guy like Nerlens Noel, if that rule isn't in place, he's already in the NBA because he probably would have been a high pick last year, and he's already got a guaranteed contract. He's already got money coming in. Now, granted, he might still go number one because this is a historically bad draft.
Right.
But, you know, potentially, if this was a better year as far as the talent level goes across the class, you know, he might be losing out on millions of dollars because he went to college for a year, hurt his knee, and severely, you know, submarined his stock. So I feel like, I mean, you see players getting, like, insurance policies on, you know, on their knees and stuff, and, you know, maybe softening the potential blow of an injury, but it's always there. And when you see it happen to one of the top guys, it's right there in the face.
Right there. And it's always a risk with that injury, man. Go ahead, Alex.
Yeah.
Alex going to stir up the pot. I know that look.
Yeah, here
I
comes
know
the contrarian look over
yes,
here.
Yes, I know that look from Alex. Go ahead, man.
Well, believe it or not, I do agree with you. And part of that comes from looking at other sports, guys. Let's look at tennis. You see 13-year-olds becoming tennis pros. Look at golf. You see, you know, the very famous 14, 15-year-old women's golfer. So from that aspect, if you can go pro in another sport, why can't you do it in the NBA? And I think a lot of that, and what Al has started to expound upon, is it's all about the money, as Cuba Gooding once said.
Yeah, you're right.
And you look at the collective bargaining agreement back years ago, that's when the rule amendment started to take place. So I think that this rule would still probably be you can come out of high school if it wasn't for the lockout, if it wasn't for all, you know, the chit-chat. Now, oh, go ahead.
No, I didn't mean to cut you off. I said I was going to jump on that and one other aspect. It was a great point of talking about other sports. And I was trying to do some research about this to find the answer. And maybe you gentlemen know I don't, but what about foreign-born basketball players? Mm-hmm. There's a front-page article in the New York Times just yesterday about a Nigerian-born Greek kid who's 18 years old.
Yeah.
And they just talk about, say, I'm looking at 18 years old. I mean, are they requiring a lot of these ball players coming out of Lithuania, out of Croatia, out of Greece? You know, you name it, you name the country.
Right.
Are they requiring them to have to sit out a year under a school system that doesn't quite align with our American high school system?
Right.
You know, I mean, how does that work for foreign-born players?
Right, exactly. Do you guys know that?
I honestly don't know.
I really don't know. I haven't done research on that.
Usually when they are those kind of foreign-born players, they're already playing professional basketball over there.
Exactly.
I mean, they're already in, you know, the top Greek league or whatever. But, you know, I feel like they're already probably out of school, at least as far as the NBA is concerned, because, again, like you said, it's all about money, and those are potential picks that people want. And you see a lot of teams stash guys overseas for a year or two. They draft them this year, and then a few years later, they finally break into the league. I mean,
now,
recently you saw it with, like, Ricky Rubio. He was 17 when he was drafted. He was
really
young.
Really, really, young.
Yeah, and he waited
look
a few years and then came up. Look at Darko.
So,
yeah.
So guys, I actually did some a little bit of research on international players. And there's actually a difference between an international player on a roster and then an international player being drafted. Now, the requirements for an international player being drafted, you have to either A, not complete high school in the United States. So you don't even have to complete high school. You just can't complete it in the United States. So you can go to a United States high school for 1 year, you know, go to Lithuania, play for 2 years, and then come at the age of 17. So as long as you don't complete U.S. high school, which is even a little fishy with that.
Right.
The
okay.
second rule is that you could have never enrolled in a U.S. college or university. And the final rule, you need to permanently reside outside of the United States for at least 3 years before the draft while playing basketball outside of the United States. So you have to reside somewhere for 3 years and play basketball for that same amount of time. Mm-hmm. So some of these guys can just play high school ball in Lithuania and come here.
Right.
Nice
now,
job.
I will,
nice job on the research.
That was great. That was great. Now, I will make this argument, though, guys. I got to say this. When you talk about high school players making the leap to the NBA, they got to be ready. Mm-hmm. That's the thing, because we've seen many cases like Sebastian Telfer. I just take him as an example. One guy who, I mean, there was so much hype on him.
So much.
Then he goes to the NBA.
Rucker Park phenom.
Right,
you know,
Rucker Park phenom. I mean, I remember watching the documentary they did, ESPN did on him. I'm thinking, this kid is going to be amazing. Then he gets to the NBA, and it's like, whoa. I mean, I think, Matt, you said he's playing for the Raptors now?
Yes.
He's been to like eight
different teams. Playing in quotes.
He was on the Timberwolves for a while.
Right, Timberwolves for a while. Yeah, he bounced around
Minnesota,
a lot.
Yes.
Right. I think when you talk about these kids, I think the scouts have to do their job and make sure these players are ready, because I think when you have a high school athlete going to the NBA, which is the creme de la creme of basketball, let's face that, it can hurt the brand a little bit. You know, it can definitely hurt the brand a little bit. And I think when you talk about international players, it's okay for them because the talent level is totally different when you talk about international basketball and the NBA. a high school athlete in Croatia or Lithuania can make that transition easier, I think, over there than a high school athlete here in the States making that to the NBA.
Right, and Telfair, he's played for seven teams, averaged 7 points per game over his career, and honestly, among some of these names, he's probably a success story.
Oh, yeah.
You know, from out of high school. Because, you know, for every LeBron James, there's a Robert Swift, who no one knows who it is and no one has ever heard of him. But, you know, he was a lottery pick for the Sonics when they existed. But, you know, you have these guys who aren't ready but have, you know, one or two skills that NBA teams are looking for, and they draft him, and it's a huge mistake. It sets the franchise back. David Stern didn't want his teams throwing $20 million at players who aren't going to pan out and are ultimately going to cost the franchise money.
But, I mean, part of the argument, pushback on that is, I mean, free enterprise and business. I mean, it goes both ways, right? If you're going to be that stupid or you have that poor of a scouting system set up, that you're going to pay $20 million to an 18-year-old kid based on a couple of hook shots.
Right.
You know, then that's your problem.
Absolutely.
On the flip side, it's also the player's problem, right?
Right.
I mean, if you're delusioned into thinking that you're good enough to play in the NBA, you've had surrounded yourself by enough people who have been rolling out the red carpet for you your whole high school career, and most of these kids, let's face it, if they're even being considered, are the BMOCs, you know, wherever they are,
right,
and have probably not been told that they've probably not been checked a little bit. And so I see some of that reasoning, but at the same time, if you're going to make that plunge, it's like starting a small business. There's a risk, and you could blow it, and you could fail. And but I think allowing that the kid the opportunity to do that. I mean, look at Greg Oden, you know, who had to go one and done. He helped Ohio State, you know, all the way. And then he has his foot problems. I mean, it seemed almost genetic. I mean, the way he had problems with his legs. He played fine for Ohio State, and then he gets to the pros, and now he's lost his earning potential, and he's where? Nowhere. I mean, maybe the Heat might take a flyer on
him.
From what I read.
Yeah.
You know, one other aspect, I think it's cool to get into a little of the history that I was doing research. There's a Detroit connection to all of this, and it started with Spencer Haywood back in 68, 69 out of the University of Detroit. But he was an All-American in 68-69. Started there earlier. Left after 3 years. Took it all the way to the Supreme Court. At the time, the NBA had a four-year rule. And the Supreme Court ruled against the NBA and opened the floodgates for people like Moses Malone and Daryl Dawkins and that kind of thing. And then, you know, fast forward to Kevin Garnett, which ushered in the new wave. As I've mentioned, I'm unfortunately from Minnesota, but unfortunately, the Timberwolves, you know, locale.
Right.
But,
right.
You know, when Garnett came, it was this huge deal, and everyone's like, oh, the Timberwolves again, they're blowing it. They're going to go this route and take a flyer on a young kid. And, you know, that worked out for them. They never really built around the guy. That's a separate story for another barbershop conversation. But, you know, there are these examples. I still don't think that the law should tell these kids that they can't do it, or the rules should.
Not at all.
And one of the other things that we haven't mentioned is how it affects college basketball, and it kills it.
It does kill it. The one and done is
killing college basketball because, I mean, you have schools like Kentucky and Kyle Wilcher, who averaged 10 points last year, he's transferring. Indiana, Remy Abel, and Maurice Creek are gone. They're making room so they can sign more players because they never know when they're going to lose them, and it's just like you rent these guys for a couple months, then, you know, spring semester rolls around, they stop going to classes because they never had any obligation to the university anyway.
Right.
Which, I mean, I feel like...
And that's when a lot of people I know, I talk to Alex about this because he's a recruiting freak. He's always on Rivals.com.
Right.
And that makes the whole recruiting game that much more crucial.
Exactly. You know, that's why we hear about recruiting more than actual games.
Think about all the violations that would come out, aside from just Oregon, from just high school players being allowed to go into the pros. There'd be recruiting in high school. Illegal boosters in high school.
I mean,
I'm pretty sure it's probably going on right now.
Indeed.
Without a doubt.
Now, how do you feel about going to sort of a baseball model where you can come out of high school and if you don't, you go to college for, let's say, 3 years? So if you're ready, because LeBron James would have dominated college basketball.
Oh, without a doubt. He wouldn't have belonged.
He was ready to
go. Man amongst boys.
He was ready to go probably in the 10th grade to the NBA. So you have players like him of his caliber who should obviously go. I feel like they, you know, just let them go. But if you're not ready, if you are a Robert Swift or an Eddie Curry or a Kwame Brown, you don't go pro out of high school, so you stay for 2 years. You give you know, you're going to be able to develop, because, you know, that's what the NBA says. You need these guys to develop, but they're not going to develop in a year. It doesn't work like that.
They can't go to the D League, though.
Exactly.
They can't go to the D League. That's what I was saying. If they don't go to college, you know, play college ball, or like you say, if they go to that baseball format where they have the option of either one going to the NBA, making that leap,
right?
Or if they decide to not make that leap, I could see the option of the D League. Or college basketball for two. I think 3 years may be a little too long. Maybe 2 years.
I mean, just
2 years probably.
Right.
Yeah.
And the other side of that to add is, let's look at what we talked about in a couple weeks ago. Broke athletes. Some of these guys transitioning from high school have no idea how to handle a certain amount of money. Of course, we've produced some of the greats like Daryl Dawkins and LeBron James and Kobe Bryant, of course. But some of these guys with a ton of money, they don't have any experience. And sure, maybe this is more of a disciplinary effort to establish some of these classes, some of these, you know, that college experience. But maybe that model could work. 2 years, maybe you get a little bit more training in the real world. Some of these athletes don't even know how to pay their own taxes. Some of them are.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, when you go to college, I mean, there's a certain level of maturity that comes with that. You mature as an individual, you mature as a player. But, you know, there's just some players that come along and some individuals and athletes that come along that just have it. Mm-hmm. You know, and if they're like I said, I agree with Joe. I mean, if they're willing to, if they have it at that age, why not give them the option to do so? So, all right, guys, final thoughts. We have 3 minutes left. Final thoughts from all three of you.
I think the development of the D League is crucial, like we were saying, because you saw, like, Brandon Jennings went overseas for a year instead of going to college, and then he was a top pick for the Bucks. I believe Glenn Rice Jr. is now in the D League, and he's looking to get drafted this year, so it's possible. But, like, the farm systems in other sports are so, like, well-structured and put in place, and they have been for so long, that is a viable option. But the D-League is just, like, in its infancy stage at this point, so I think developing that will be key in this debate going forward.
Right. Yeah, just one quote really struck me. This is from Kansas State freshman Bill Walker. Mm-hmm. When he was a junior in high school, he said this: "I don't see why you have to be 19 to play basketball when you can be 18 and go to war for our country and die. It's ridiculous."
Yeah. Well, that's why they changed voting age, you know, during the Vietnam War. Exactly. But right. I think this speaks to a broader issue about it. The NCAA and college sports is broken. And I think in general, we have to deal with this issue, among others, and just start finding a way to compensate these kids, or you're going to have the one and done in college basketball and screwing up these programs. You're going to have football players, you know, with the booster issues and the injuries and these kinds of things, and not being able to maximize their own earning potential.
Exactly.
While the universities and the NCAA and the TV networks make billions of dollars.
Make billions.
Free labor.
So, all right, NBA, give them the option, man. I really hope I see it changed in the future. I just think it makes it more exciting, too. I mean, you got this kid out of high school who's a phenom. I mean, people are going to tune in and watch. And, you know, I really hope to see it happen in the future. All right, well, before we leave, a special thanks to everyone that contributed to today's episode of Current Sports. Alex Sharg and Matt Ludke, production assistants. Intern Mike Corey, engineer Aaron Young, Peter Worf, our station manager here at WKR. Thanks to author Doug Wilson for joining us, and also producer of Current State, Joe Lindstroth. Have a fantastic day, folks. You've been listening to Current Sports with me, Al Martin, on WKAR East Lansing and WKAR FM HD3 East Lansing. Be easy, people.